books written by authors who did not have the benefit of modern science and understanding. The Earth is demonstrably more than 6,000 years old, and contemplating creation is enhanced by an understanding of galaxies, relativity, quantum mechanics, and evolution. Does this rational approach mean that we're uninspired, non-spiritual, devoid of awe, and no fun? This morning, I'd like to do three things related to rationality, which seems to be important to so many Unitarians. First, I'll offer a viewpoint that being rational and scientific can actually enhance one's sense of awe, and that we should not only be proud of being Unitarians, but also should be passionate and ecstatic. I'm going to add my glasses to make this print look even better. Second, I'll explore some limitations of the rational approach, which will lead into some environmental analysis, which is appropriate since this is the end of Earth Week. And third, I'll talk a little bit about dealing with the distress caused by understanding today's environmental issues. So let's get started with what I call atheist awe. Technically, I'm an agnostic rather than an atheist. Richard Dawkins states that all atheists are technically agnostics because there's no way we can possibly be sure. I like Woody Allen's version. There's no way to prove that there is no God. You just have to take it on faith. I refer to myself as an atheist because it seems highly unlikely to me that there is a supreme being. So I don't experience the awe of being loved by God or guided or part of a supreme being's plan. When something goes wrong, I attribute it to random chance. I don't pray for good things. I just hope I'll be one of the lucky ones. And so far I am. When I look at the amazing complexity of natural phenomena, I experience awe. But I don't attribute this to God's design. I attribute it to the interaction of random chance and evolutionary forces. That something as simple as survival of the fittest and random variation could create monarch butterflies which migrate between Mexico and northern Canada over four insect generations is beyond astonishing to me. Many other examples in the natural world are beautiful, coincidental, complex, and just plain amazing. Astronomy is another source for inspiration. The unfathomable vastness of the distances, the billions and billions of stars in each galaxy, and the billions and billions of galaxies. The discovery of black matter, which was discovered by Vera Rubin, who observed that the rotation of stars within galaxies violated Newton's laws. Vera Rubin died Christmas Day in 2016 without receiving a Nobel Prize for this seminal discovery. I am awed by Einstein's mental explorations, which led to the theory of special relativity more than a century ago. Schrödinger's cat, the failure to find any signs of life elsewhere in the universe despite the overwhelming odds in favor. Our fascination with a solar eclipse, the discoveries and awe shared by Stephen Hawking. All of these inspire in me a reverence and appreciation. Did you know that Stephen Hawking died on Einstein's birthday, March 14th? Well, good for you. That such discoveries could come from a species which continues to wage war, to exploit, to discriminate against, and ignore the poverty of their fellow beings, as well as to ignore the obvious conclusions about the dangers of CO2 emissions is amazing in its own perverse way. Then there is the awe of human interaction, a baby's smile or laugh, hearing a great or just a catchy piece of music, viewing a painting, getting a joke, crying at a true or fictitious story, reaching an agreement, participating in a group response. These may be the best part of being human. In what sense are these moments of awe spiritual? They seem spiritual to me in two ways. First, they grab me into the present. And secondly, they remind me that I am part of something greater than myself, greater than my preoccupations, my frustrations, and strivings, part of something wonderful. It may not seem like a religious experience to some, but so it seems to me. A common consequence of being passionate about something is the desire to tell others about it. People frequently remark that Unitarians don't evangelize or proselytize. My response is, sure we do, but only about movies, books, and restaurants. Anytime you hear a you utter the phrase, you just gotta, there's probably a movie, a book, or a restaurant involved. In our fear of being annoying, we keep our enthusiasm for this religious community a secret. In a cynical world, it's not cool to be too enthusiastic. Well, I am here today to say that I'm a Unitarian, and I am glad, and I am proud of it. Yes, I am proud. Yes, I am. Whatever you call us, we're pretty amazing. We have a long, and we have funny names. I won't go into that. But we have a long record of being on the right side of history, from fighting slavery and supporting women's suffrage, to marching for civil rights and supporting same-sex marriage. Lower mainland UUs supported U.S. war resisters during the Vietnam War. We have been at the forefront of the environmental movement going back to the founding of SPEC, which allegedly was founded in the North Shore Church, and Greenpeace. It's an enviable record. But as we rhapsodize about the virtues of rationality, we need to realize it's not that simple. Two different rational people can arrive at different conclusions. Rational people can disagree. Part of the problem is that rational analysis interacts with perspective, with personal values. And Unitarians prize values maybe even more than we prize rationality. So I'm now going to evangelize about a book which explores this interaction between values and scientific rationality. In his brilliant work, The Wizard and the Prophet, Charles C. Mann frames the values conflict facing us today by tracking the lives of two scientists born in the early 1900s. They laid the foundations of today's environmental movement. The prophet was William Vogt, an ornithologist who popularized the concept of carrion capacity, and who prophesied that if humans didn't respect and stay within environmental limits, the environment would be degraded to the point where human survival would be jeopardized. The wizard was Norman Borlaug, who was pretty much single-handedly responsible for the Green Revolution. He crossbred wheat plants until he got a species that was prolific, disease-resistant, had short stalks strong enough to support a large bundle of wheat seeds, could grow anywhere, and produce easy to mill and tasty flour. The new wheat strain, introduced in 1962, along with a similar program for rice that he was also involved with, increased rice and wheat output by threefold and saved a billion lives. Borlaug and other wizards view environmental issues as problems to be solved and view carrying capacity as a constraint to be extended through technology. The book is filled with fascinating details about these men, the environmental issues they addressed, and the history of the environmental movement. As I read, I realized that I had met many prophets and many wizards in my years as an environmentalist. Many of my environmentalist friends, and I believe this includes David Suzuki, are prophets. They believe that the main problem is humans exceeding limits, and that the solution is a less materialistic, less acquisitive, less capitalistic, and less technological society. Other environmentalists, including Bill McKibben, Steven Pinker, and myself, believe that science and technology have already improved air pollution, acid rain, ozone levels, as well as world poverty levels, and have an important role to play in saving humanity from global warming. While any betting person would be disturbed by the odds at this time against humans keeping global warming in check, there are hopeful signs. At a recent talk at the Vancouver Church on electric cars, I reported that by 2025, electric cars should have all the capabilities of gasoline cars, including long trips, and cost less. The cost of batteries is going down rapidly. They already cost 1/6 as much to fuel and to maintain. And I have an electric car, and I love it. Didn't bring it today because my wife stole it. Before 2030, municipal and other levels of government should be banning the purchase of new gas-powered cars. Worldwide, fossil fuel accounts for 87% of CO2 emissions. Transport accounts for 22% of the fossil fuel use. 16 of that 22% is road use, 3% is marine, and 2.4% is aviation. 41% of fossil fuel use, compared to the 22% for transport, is for electrical generation. And here the difference between prophets and wizards is significant. Wizards see the growth of wind and solar electrical generation, even in committed jurisdictions like Germany, see that it's not growing fast enough to keep up with the growth in demand for electricity, let alone to displace fossil fuel generation. In Germany, which has decided to phase out its nuclear power, the substantial increase in solar and wind power has only been enough to replace the reduction in nuclear generation. New coal-fired generated plants have been built to meet the growing demand. Wizard environmentalists, while applauding a massive increase in sustainables like wind and solar, believe that the only way to get rid of fossil fuel electric generation is with an also massive increase in nuclear generation. These environmentalists include Bill McKibben and also Mark Lynas, who followed his book 6 Degrees, Our Future on a Hotter Planet, which is one of my favorite books of all time, with another book recently entitled Nuclear 2.0, Why a Green Future Needs Nuclear Power. And that brings me to my last topic, the effect that not solving the global warming problem is having on our young people and on ourselves. At the recent Metro Unitarian gathering at the Vancouver Church on April 7th, a young adult panel member listed global warming as a major factor in making her life difficult. And I, and I'm sure many of you, are dealing with a despair from seeing the lack of action and the vapid statements of political leaders and candidates. While the BC government is taking a highly visible stand on the Kinder Morgan pipeline, BC will not meet its 2030 emissions objectives and has not set any objective for 2030. Despite our amazingly creative social advances, amazing creativity, our social advances, and our technology, humans are still bellicose, acquisitive, status-seeking, and short-sighted. Shakespeare has been torn by this dual nature of humanity since 1623. What a piece of work is man! How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form and moving, how express and admirable, in action, how like an angel, in apprehension, how like a god, the beauty of the world, the paragon of animals. And yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust? Man delights not me, nor woman neither. According to Stephen Hawking, we are just an advanced breed of monkeys on a minor planet on a very average star. But we can understand the universe. That makes us something very special. In addition to understanding the universe, we can understand the effects of a gas which constitutes less than 0.04% of the atmosphere, but threatens our very existence on this minor planet. It's still not too late. We have to convince our leaders and our neighbors that we as a species are up to the task. As we undertake this mission, we have to use our rationality and our values. We have to be aware of the many threats to clear thinking in ourselves, but mostly in others. Which interpretation of peace of work will we deserve? In the last chapter of The Wizard and the Prophet, Charles Mann is looking for a sign of hope. He points out that after thousands of years, when slavery was an important component of every human economy, slavery practically vanished worldwide in the 1800s. More recently, we are seeing a significant change in the nearly constant historical subjugation of women to men. And now we are seeing a major shift in gay rights and a major reduction of the violence due to war. All four of these changes occurred because of the acceptance of new ideas about what is moral and just. It's possible that humanity could accept the threat of global warming and change fast enough to pull back from the abyss. The economic costs are far less than those from ending slavery. It's estimated the value of slaves in 1860 in the United States was $2 trillion. As Charles Mann tells it, our record of success is not that long, but it is terrible to suppose that we could get so many other things right and get this one thing wrong. To have the imagination to see our potential end, but not have the cultural resources to avoid it. To send humankind to the moon, but fail to pay attention to Earth. To have the potential to be able to use it. To have the potential, but to be unable to use it. It would be evidence that the most dismissive beliefs had been right after all. For all our speed and voraciousness, our changeable sparkles and flash, we would be, at last count, not an especially interesting species. On Friday in the Vancouver Sun, there was a review of a movie from Quebec entitled Earth Seen from the Heart. The only show that I found in Vancouver is today at 4 o'clock at the Park Theater. I plan to be there. While being honest about our current situation, it also offers hope. As is said in the movie, we must act as if we are going to triumph, even though we may not. But even if humanity fails to meet this challenge, humans at their best are magnificent. There is much to celebrate, and Unitarians know how to create a community for celebrating the best of humanity. So let's be sure that we do that as we work for a better world and a smarter species. Thank you.
And there are words of meditation in your order of service. I will read them, and I'm going to add a couple more words. None of us can do great things, but we can do small things with great love. And I add, those small things can become great things. Those are your words for meditation, and will be brought out of our meditation beautifully by Derek's playing.